Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. Welcome to another scintillating week of books and arts here on RN. Today, a new theatre company presents Shakespeare's very masculine play, Coriolanus. It's a production with a difference.
Let's take the most aggressive, hyper-masculine, bloody, fierce play and flip it on its head and see what happens when these characters become women.
Yes, an all-female Coriolanus later in the program. And a theatre show is nothing without design. One of Australia's leading theatre designers, Hugh Coleman, joins us, and the poet Chris Wallace Crabb will be along to read us a sonnet. It's nice to be with you this Monday morning. Well, in Hamlet, Shakespeare has Queen Gertrude tell the troubled prince that all that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. Now, Through Nature to Eternity is the name of a concert that's been given by the award-winning Tin Alley String Quartet, who've built a huge name for themselves here and in Europe over the past decade. Two members of the Tin Alley String Quartet, the first violinist Adam Chalaby and cellist Michelle Wood, are in our Sydney studio. Welcome, nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And also joining us is the astonishingly beautiful singer and songwriter Lior, who's performing in this concert. Hi, Lior.
Hi, Michael.
Lovely to have you on board as well. Adam and Michelle, let's start with you. You're performing a program of all sorts of works, new and old, in Sydney and then in Melbourne. But let's have some music first. You're going to play some Bach for us. What are you going to play?
We are. It's a two-part invention. It's something that's actually traditionally done on keyboard, actually. So, but they're just two lines, so it fits the violin and cello fairly well.
So one of you is going to be the right hand, and one of you is going to be the left.
Indeed, I am the very functional left hand for the morning.
Now, you were practicing this before we came to air, Michelle, and it seems to me that you follow in Adam's footsteps all the way through. You're sort of trudging after him.
I sort of do. I mean, I hope I don't trudge too heavily. but no, it's a funny little piece. We kind of we chase around each other a little bit, but also as I was saying before, it's funny. You know, sometimes Adam likes to think that I follow him. Otherwise, it's usually me making him think that I follow him.
So you think you're on the beat and Adam's off the beat?
Exactly.
Is that what's happening? All right, we'll let the audience decide. Off you go.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. that was very nice. Now, it didn't sound as though you were following him, Michelle. It sounded as though you were picking up little offerings that he was strewing about.
Oh, sorry. I just didn't have my headphones on. Oh.
I was just congratulating you. Well done. I was just congratulating you on your fine playing. I should explain to the audience that Adam and Michelle are in Sydney and I'm not in Sydney, so I can't see them. That's why. There's some little disconnect.
We've now magically reappeared.
So, Adam, I was just telling the audience that it sounded to me as though you actually were on the beach and that you were strewing flowers and petals around that Michelle then gathered up.
Yes, she tends to gather up my mess, so that's a fair reflection of how things work.
Is that life imitating art?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're playing in the key of E, which is a hard key to play in before lunchtime, although easy if you're a guitarist. Guitarists love the key of E, but violinists don't, so keen on that one. So...
Yeah.
Now, this is a little odd, because that piece, lovely as it is, isn't in your program.
No. It's not. It's just a little taste of... we have a very, very program. We're presenting a really exciting program, and together with Lior, it's a real sort of eclectic mix of things from both the standard and not so standard quartet repertoire, and mixed with some new commissions which Lior's been working on with composer Aid Vincent and Lior singing himself, and that's been immensely exciting to put together.
So the program is called A Musical Narrative of Love, Loss and Compassion. That's the subtitle to it. Mm-hmm. So there is some kind of logic. Is there emotional unity to the event?
I think there is, actually. I mean, part of what made us think differently about how we're presenting concerts, particularly for this one, but also just generally for Tinelli, for our series, is we were thinking about really, I mean, life as a musician is such a varied one for us. We get to do so many different things. And this is really, in some ways, sort of a narrative of exactly how music can really punctuate and... sort of tell the story of kind of exactly how you live out your life, you know, as a musician. You know, you've got lots of different pieces that even as a quartet, the Ravel for us is, as for Tinelli, has been a piece we've had since we had almost just begun as a quartet. So that for us is very much part of us as a group. And then this whole idea that the narrative of, you know, how music can really, you know, tell the story of someone's life, how it can talk about, you know, the love, the loss, you know, and generally, and then towards the end with this reimagining of Shim Shalom from Nigel Westlake and Lior's Compassion. That's, you know, really about peace and it's just, I don't know, the story of this whole concert for us has actually been a really wonderful journey to create.
Yeah, it sounds a beautifully reflective selection that you've put together. So, Lior, let's talk about the pieces you're working on. You've created a piece with Aid Vincent, as Michelle was saying. Tell us about this. It features the works of two poets.
Yeah, so Aid was commissioned to write a work and approached me about he knew that he wanted to do to include the vocal performance as part of it, and he approached me about composing it together. And it was when we looked at the program that Tinelli had put together, the theme that really that really felt like that was a common thread was one of transience and life cycle. And so Aid and I, as opposed to you know my usual process where I write the lyrics, we thought it would be interesting to source a couple of poems that really resonated within us that speak of life cycle and transience and compose the music to it. So we went through quite a bit of material, but we landed on two poems that we really connected with. One is a Dylan Thomas poem called "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night," which is quite a well-known poem. And the other is called "Hours" by Hazel Hall, which is lesser known, but also has a very strong theme of transience running through it.
So Hazel Hall is an American poet, isn't she, who died in 1924, not so well known, as you say, as the Dylan Thomas. And you've had such a diverse musical career, Lior. I mean, I first encountered you when you were working with Nigel Westlake on a big piece. You've worked with the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. You're performing in Fiddler on the Roof in Sydney. There seems to be no barriers to the musical forms that you'll take on. What was your own musical background? What was your training?
Well, I come from a very unconventional musical upbringing, in the sense that, you know, my family wasn't a particularly musical family. I sort of was gravitated towards the guitar at around about the age of 10, and then I started singing pretty badly, may I add. But you know, I was just very determined and fell in love with singing and composing and see what I could come up with on guitar. And by the age of 14, 15, I was pretty hooked on songwriting. And so I think I'm very much a self-taught musician, and you know, that has its advantages and disadvantages, of course, but one advantage is that, you know, it sort of allowed me to sort of be on the periphery of many genres and work with so many wonderful people, and just, you know, get a taste of a lot of things.
Well, you're going to sing for us now. This is a song that's in the program, I gather.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's one of my own compositions. Tin Alley suggested that it might be nice to have you know, me just take a moment through the beautiful their beautiful pieces, and just to have a quiet moment on my own. And I was thinking about what song of mine really relates to this theme, and this next song called My Grandfather is certainly the most in tune with the theme of life cycle, I think, that I've composed. When I was born, my grandfather held me in his warm hands. And it seems though his eyes are teary, but it's hard to tell from the old photograph. While my brother and sister danced at the feet of his tired and weathered frame, he said, "There's a light to this boy I've rarely seen, and there he gave me my name." Well, my grandfather was a sniper in the Red Army. He never knew any brothers in arms, for on both sides stood enemy. With a cold, unbroken will to survive, his steady hand took aim. And he drank just enough to keep himself warm, for he never spoke his true name. When I was a boy, the summers were ours. He would take me down to the sea. He'd stand on the water's edge and watch me go crazy as the gentle waves rolled in. Looking back, I wonder how he must have felt watching me running so free. All the years in his life he wished he could forget, did he look at the world through me? When I was a man, I flew across the ocean. When I heard he needed care, I listened as he spoke of his turbulent life from his ordinary chair. And he ended by saying, "Oh, I've had enough. The time's come for me to go. I have only one wish that is left in me, to be taken peacefully." Just before I was due to marry, I heard he could not walk anymore. It was then he gave up fight. I had said goodbye almost 1 year before. And I'll never forget something he told me. Yes, it's a cruel world, but you must live without fear. Well, I sure do miss my grandfather. He's the reason why I'm here.
Leo performing My Grandfather here on Books and Arts, and Leora's part of a program or performing in a program alongside the Tin Alley String Quartet. It's called Through Nature to Eternity. Now, the program will conclude, or the concert will conclude, with a work by the composer Nigel Westlake, the Australian composer Nigel Westlake, that was created for orchestra for the Sydney Symphony, actually, called Compassion. And you're in this, or you helped him create this work, Lior, and it's been rescored for the string quartet. So Michelle and Adam from the string quartet, how does that work? How does rescoring change the work?
Oh, hugely, actually. I mean, I had the pleasure of actually playing with Melbourne Symphony and Lior when Lior performed it in Melbourne. And it's a hugely lush work. I mean, one of the most beautiful things about Nigel's music is that, I mean, when he scores for orchestra, it's so lush and full of colour. And
optimism, I always
think.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, and it's hugely uplifting. And so actually one of the hardest things, I think, about putting that in a quartet, which is obviously so intimate, is that, you know, are you going to lose that sort of the lushness? I mean, you lose the vast scoring, but I think actually there's something really beautiful, particularly with the movement that he chose and that we've chosen. The intimacy of it is actually quite special as well. So pairing it back to essentially its very essence, because you're only dealing with four voices, you know, into four kind of the quartet voices, is it's been really interesting, and I was actually incredibly surprised and happily so, because it's created something very different, but equally as beautiful, I think.
Well, it does sound like a joyful conclusion to a marvellously reflective concert. Thanks to all three of you for coming in. It's been such a joy and a privilege, actually, to hear you performing live for us, including in the key of E, first thing in the morning, here on Books and Arts.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
So the concert's called Through Nature to Eternity, and it's performed by the Tin Alley String Quartet and by Lior. And it's at the Sydney Opera House tonight and tomorrow night. And then they move to Melbourne to the Recital Centre on Wednesday night. That's Adam Chalaby and Michelle Wood. They're one half of the Tin Alley String Quartet, and also Lior, who is the guest artist performing with the quartet. This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart. Yes, you can't have too many tutus, can you? That's the Dance of the Little Swans from Tchaikovsky's much-loved ballet Swan Lake, and the Australian Ballet is currently touring Swan Lake. And look, you're familiar with the names of the choreographer, I guess, Stephen Baines, and the lead ballerina, she's Amber Scott, but can you name the designer? Well, the designer is Hugh Coleman, and he's one of Australia's leading theatre, dance and opera designers. A new exhibition at the Arts Centre in Melbourne called Stage Presence celebrates Aussie theatre designers. It includes some of Hugh Coleman's work. He joins us right now. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice of you to wear your tutu. You look marvellous.
Thank you.
And also in the tutu is Tim Fisher, who's the curator.
Good morning.
I didn't know you could work on point, Tim, but it was a magnificent entrance you made here to the studio. Tim, why did you decide to focus on design, set and costume in this new exhibition? What's the rationale?
Well, Michael, really, the Arts Centre is fortunate to hold the Australian Performing Arts Collection, which is a very big collection which documents the history of Australian performing arts.
Where is it?
It's all under the Arts Centre or in various other stores. And one of the largest parts of that collection is the design collection. I've started using the term performance design.
Right. So what's it for? Why is there this big collection? It's not on permanent display.
Look, it's not on permanent display, but we do four exhibitions per year out of the collection. And this is a classic example where this really important and interesting part of the collection, we're trying to show the general public what's in that collection.
So, Hugh, tell us about some of the works that you've contributed to this. What's on show?
I've got a couple of pieces there. One that I did for the Australian Ballet called Scuola di Ballo, School of Dance, which was choreographed by Alexei Ratmansky, which was a very exciting time for myself and for the ballet. And the other piece is from The Lion and the Witch in the Wardrobe, which opened at the Arts Centre in 2000, which was essentially, it was a kind of piece of theatre built around puppetry. Most of the sort of fabulous characters in it were puppets, and my job was to provide a set that they could work in and costumes for the human beings in it.
And is that the way the gig normally works? You design a set and the costumes, the whole package?
I like to design both of those, but quite often these days the jobs will be divided up if it's a very large production. But it's very hard to not sort of see both of them if you're a designer in your head, if you know what I mean.
I want these clothes in this space.
That's right.
I get the logic of that.
Exactly.
So in this exhibition, what do we see of yours? Do we see models of the set? Are there sketches? How does that work?
There are sketches. There's a sketch of the model for the ballet and sketches for the costumes. And with the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, there's one of the main costumes, which is the White Witch. So that's there, and the costume drawings.
So how does it start, Hugh? What happens? A director or an artistic director gives you a call and says to you, OK, we're doing Macbeth. How does the conversation unfold?
Pretty much from there. It's nearly always driven by the director. Sometimes maybe the artistic director of the company, but usually by the director or choreographer of the piece. And it's a series of conversations after that of where you might like to go together on this particular
journey.
So
suppose I say to you, look, I want to set Macbeth in a sort of urban wasteland.
Sure.
Do you say that sounds terrific, or do you say, have you thought about Scotland?
Probably both, because until you have to, you want to leave it wide open
right.
to where you might go with it.
Right.
Set it in Glasgow.
Well, why not? I mean, you think about Macbeth, I've never seen it done with Scottish accents.
Oh, there's the film. There's the Orson Welles film.
Is that
where
the Scottish
actress
accents?
Who plays Lady Macbeth has quite a strong Scottish accent.
They should all have Scottish accents. Suddenly
it sounds
occurs
pretty,
to me.
Pretty weird, I have to tell you.
Well, now the Scots are going to write in.
Yes.
And you won't be here to answer the mail, Hugh. I'll have to do it. Now, Tim, I guess you've had to commission a designer to design the exhibition.
We have. We've commissioned the wonderful Anna Cordingley, who's one of the leading younger designers, I guess.
Absolutely.
You would say. In fact, her current production, which she designed of Romeo and Juliet, has been in the Arts Centre for the last couple of weeks as well, the Bell Shakespeare Show. So she's had two things in the Arts Centre in the recent past, and she's done a terrific job at really making this exhibition look very stylish and very stylized, I guess.
Now, that's an interesting case to take, because the design for Bell Shakespeare's production of Romeo and Juliet is very simple. I mean, it's in a very simple theatre. It's not a theatre that has lots of things that go up and down. There's no fly. There's no fly. So you've really got to just put stuff on stage and leave it there. Hugh, how does that change the way you think a production through? Because sometimes, I guess, you're designing a production that will then travel. Are you
sure.
able to do a sort of glamorous version for the opera house and then a cut-down version for touring, or do you have to take into account that in the end it's going to end up in a provincial theatre and that's your kind of limit?
Pretty much the latter, Michael, because if you know from the word go that it's going to tour, you have to make something that's flexible. I mean, that is the given. We find, for example, with the ballet company, when you go to Sydney, you have to have designed a set that will shrink into the opera theatre because it's so much smaller than most of the other venues. But essentially, it will have to be the same production because the choreography won't be changing.
Right. So you have to have secret panels.
Secret panels that you can
take out.
Or bits that you leave off.
How absolutely marvellous. And what's the smallest space you've ever designed for?
Probably Red Stitch Theatre.
Oh, well, that's a tiny theatre in Melbourne.
It's fantastic.
It's a beautiful theatre, but it's a little bit like a bus that's
yes.
been tilted up. We
yes.
feel as though we're all sitting in the bus and there's a sort of small area at the front that suits shows set in apartments terribly well. Do you remember what the show was you designed?
I do. I've done two pieces there. One was not exactly set in an apartment. And that was called The Night Season.
Oh, that was a while ago. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful play, I thought. But the great thing about a theatre like Red Stitch is the intimacy between the audience and the performance. There's nothing like it.
Yeah. So let's come back to the ballet, Hugh, because I guess the ballet must be a first love, is it?
It is pretty much my first love now, yeah.
And what draws you to the ballet in particular?
Well, always the music, if you're working on something that exists. And that's like... the collaborator of all collaborators for me. And same with opera, of course, and even sometimes just music to help you into a play if it doesn't have music. There's something that music releases, particularly in me. I think it's not something I can rationalise exactly.
Do you listen to music while you're designing?
I do, yeah.
To the music from the show, presumably?
Well, always from the show, but with Swan Lake, I can't think how many times I listen to various recordings of it. Because it gives you so much. And it is literally like having another collaborator in the space, not one you can exactly talk to, but you ask questions in your mind. And you, if you listen closely, I think you get answers.
And Hugh, have designers always been in demand, or has it ebbed and flowed? I mean, my impression is that in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of very cutback theatre, you know, that sets and costumes were seen as sort of ephemeral and getting in the way of the essential muscularity of the work.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that in the 60s and 70s, a lot of the theatre companies had their own resident designers, and that's something that's changed quite a lot over the last 10 or 20 years. It's mostly freelancers now. Mm. And obviously with a theatre company, I started out with the Melbourne Theatre Company, and they had two or three resident designers who took care of the year's shows. And it, I think the way you described it characterised quite a lot of productions. But there were always those exceptions where they thought, oh, it's probably time to give the audience something glamorous now.
Yes, well, there's always someone who wants some glamour. That's
but yes,
how you stay in work.
When you think back to the RSC's black and white box productions, they were very influential on us through that time. Mm,
mm. And how does a person start in all of this? How did you get going, Hugh?
Well, when I got going, I would have had to leave Australia to study because there wasn't a design course. And I was very fortunate. I got a kind of apprenticeship with the Melbourne Theatre Company. I got a holiday job recommended through a friend and learnt on the job and fell in love with it. And I don't think that's an option that's available anymore. I think everybody would be expected now to have done a course.
Well, the Melbourne Theatre Company has enormous facilities. Sure. And when you were involved, they had very big facilities.
They did.
They had a very big workshop and just on the edge of the main city area.
Yes.
And where there was a huge team working away. It was so much fun to go there because there were all these clever people who were making, you know, French furniture or telephone boxes or whatever was required. Just such skill.
It was a fantastic world to be in.
Yeah. And Tim, how did you get involved in all this? What draws you to this?
I was an art curator for many years, Michael, up in Canberra at the National Gallery, and then was very fortunate when we moved to Melbourne to get the job at Art Centre Melbourne with the Performing Arts Collection. And it's an unusual collection because it balances halfway between art and social history, I guess you would say.
So what else is in it?
We collect everything about live performing arts. So we don't try and double up with the National Film and Sound Archive about television and film. So we, under that live performing arts banner, we collect practically everything you could possibly imagine.
From across Australia?
From across Australia now, yeah. We started as a kind of Victorian collection, and now we very much have a national
focus. But when
focus.
You say everything, I mean, you couldn't save the sets of shows, for
no.
example.
But we do, for instance, save set models. And in this exhibition, we have some wonderful set models, including from Melbourne Theatre Company, by some very well-known designers. And they're gorgeous little things because in this exhibition, you peer through a little window into the life of the play or the performance.
Well, one of the beautiful moments in building a production is when the set designer meets the cast for the first time, and you have a kind of show and tell where the designer gets up and says, now this is what you'll be wearing, and presents them either with a model or these days often with a kind of computer graphic of the model, and they see the world that they're about to enter into for the next 6 weeks as they rehearse the play. Mm. That must be a marvellous moment. In fact, that's your kind of opening night, isn't it, as the designer?
Yes.
They're your audience.
With opening night nerves, I can tell you too.
Well, it's kind of interesting that when you go to the production as an audience member and sit down, even before the production, the design is giving you a lot of what is to come. So, you know, the costume design can identify characters and the set design can set up a kind of imaginary world. So it very much happens with the audience as well, I think.
Is there any aspiration to create a permanent museum, a public museum, where this can be put on display, or are you happy with this idea of coming out into the daylight four times a year?
We would love to have a permanent museum. Michael, we've been pushing and agitating for a permanent museum, but there's At the moment, there seems to be a hesitancy amongst government to fund new organisations. We are trying to put as much from the collection out on display in these changing exhibitions as possible, while trying to keep up the pressure for our own space.
Well, I hope you do get a space, because it seems like such a shame that all this stuff is in boxes in the dark. Thank you so much for coming in. It's been such a joy to talk to you both.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
Designer Hugh Coleman and curator Tim Fisher. The show's called Stage Presence, which is a very nice name. It's on at the Arts Centre in Melbourne until the 4th of September. So that's ages, absolutely ages. If you're passing through Melbourne, you've got a whole season or two to catch up with that one. I'm Michael Cathcart. You're on Radio National, where you're listening to Books and Arts.
Ben Quilty paints, Andrew Ford composes. Neighbours, they should be working, but often talk instead.
Do you sometimes find that when you finished something, you don't remember how you did it?
Always.
Okay, because it's not just me.
No. Oh, that was my question for you.
Ben and Andrew tear it up and start afresh. Download them by looking for Earshot on the RN homepage.
Suzanne Vega, that's creepily appropriate for what we're about to talk about now. It's a new theatre production in Melbourne. It's Shakespeare's play Coriolanus. Now, Coriolanus is a warrior who was pushed by his mum and his friends into the snake pit of Roman politics. It's a very bloody tale of war, of pride and of power. And you'd have to say it's a pretty blokey story. But this production is performed entirely by women. It's the first show from Heartstring Theatre. They're a company devoted to getting more women on stage. Elisa Armstrong and Joe Booth are the co-founders of Heartstring. They're also in the cast, and they're talking to Georgia Moody.
Elisa, what prompted you to found your new company, Heartstring Theatre?
Well, Joe and I had done a play reading last year and we got along really well, and we went to Sydney to just have a theatre trip. We were sitting outside in the sun having a glass of wine and decided that if we wanted to do something, we should do something together. We both love Shakespeare, so we decided for our first production to do an all-female Shakespeare, and that's sort of how Heartstring came about.
I know that you want to address the lack of roles for female actors. Joe, is it the sheer number of female roles that you're protesting against, or is it the type of roles that tend to be given to female actors?
I think there's definitely a lack of really good, interesting female roles for women. I think this is across the board in film and TV and theatre. So often you go to the theatre and you just see a lot of men on stage, and women are usually the girlfriends or the wives or the maid. So I think we as Heartstring want to address both quality and quantity. And by doing that, we're going to make sure that at least 50% of the cast and crew are women.
Elisa, why do you think there are fewer women up on stage?
Oh, how much time do you have? For me, it comes from there's a huge societal aspect of it. So when Shakespeare was writing in his time, women were very rarely seen in powerful positions. There was Queen Elizabeth and people like that. But I think that history has not been kind to women. We don't know a lot of stories about women. And even doing this show, we're playing warriors and we were thinking, oh, okay, who are some historical references? But the more you dig deeper, you find that there have been female warriors through thousands of years. There have been female pirates. There have been women who now currently are fighting on the front lines. But we don't hear these stories because primarily the people who are writing the stories and telling the stories are men.
As you said, your first production is of Shakespeare's play Coriolanus. It's a tragedy. It's the second last tragedy that Shakespeare wrote. Elisa, what story does the play tell?
The play tells the story of a woman who has been raised as a warrior and her entire life and comes back a war hero. She's fettered by a lot of people, but she knows that the plebs in society should be the plebs. The patricians should be the patricians. This has caused quite a rift.
She's quite a hierarchical person.
Absolutely, absolutely, which, you know, I don't agree with at all for my personal politics, but she's very honest about the way she goes about it, which I think is admirable. So she comes back a war hero and there has been this huge rift, and because a few of the politicians want to use her, they're the puppeteers pulling the strings, they try to put her into a position of power and it doesn't go well. So she is then forced to look elsewhere to find power, and it kind of raises the question of when there is nowhere to turn or no one to turn to, who do you turn to and where do you go?
It's famously one of Shakespeare's most masculine plays. It's about war and blood and power. Jo, why did you choose to stage Coriolanus as your first play at Heartstring?
We kind of went through all of the Shakespeare plays, and that just really stood out for us as, for those reasons. Let's take the most aggressive, hyper-masculine, bloody, fierce play and flip it on its head and see what happens when these characters become women. So what we're doing in the play is we're not pretending to be men. The characters are women. So what happens when women and us as actors investigate our rage, our vulnerability, and, you know, hopefully we show all facets of what it is to be a woman. I mean, I think there's so many interesting characters on stage, you know, from the very vulnerable to the very fierce. And I don't know, I mean, women have a lot of anger, so it wasn't so shocking to me to pick Coriolanus and explore that.
Elisa, you play the leading warrior, mm-hmm. Coriolanus. Mm-hmm. But Jo, you play two very different roles.
I do.
Tell me about the two characters you play.
So I play Aufidius, who is Coriolanus's greatest rival, and they have a very, very, very strong connection. So, I mean, Coriolanus is most at home on the battlefield and talks about Aufidius as, you know, her greatest rival. And so it's this very interesting connection that we have between us. So we get to fight and beat each other up. And we've had some, you know, fantastic fight training. And, you know, that's been really fun to explore that. And then I also play Coriolanus's wife, you know, and we chose that because we thought, how interesting to make, you know, the woman that Coriolanus goes home to and the woman that she meets on the battlefield played by the same actor. So it's very challenging, and it's been really interesting to work on two roles that are very, very different and looking at what do I want to show in that character and what do I want to bring out in that character.
You're going to perform a scene from the play now. Elisa, where does this scene sit in the play?
So Coriolanus and Aufidius are the greatest rivals, but they don't meet that often in the play. We see them separately quite a lot. And so when this scene takes place, they have met, and it preempts hopefully a really interesting fight scene.
Whence comest thou? What wouldst thou? Thy name? Why speak'st not? Speak, girl. What's thy name?
If, Tullus, not yet thou knowest me, and seeing me dost not think me for the one I am, necessity commands me name myself.
What is thy name?
A name unmusical to the Volscian ears and harsh in sound to thine.
I know thee not. Thy name?
My name is Caius Martius, who hath done to thee particularly and to all the Volscians great hurt and mischief. Thereto witness may my surname Coriolanus.
Oh, I have much of late dreamt of encounters twixt thyself and me. We have been down together in my sleep, unbuckling helms, fisting each other's throat, and waked half dead with nothing.
I'll fight with none but thee, for I do hate thee worse than a promise breaker.
We hate alike. Not Afric owns a serpent I abhor more than thy fame and envy. Fix thy foot.
Let the first budger die the other's slave, and the gods doom her after.
If I fly, Martius, holloa me like a hare.
Within these 3 hours, Tullus, alone I fought in your Corioli's walls and made what work I pleased. "'Tis not my blood wherein thou seest me masked. For thy revenge, wrench up thy power to the highest.
Wert thou the Hector that was the whip of your braggart progeny, thou shouldst not scape me here."
Alyssa Armstrong and Joe Booth performing a scene from Coriolanus, the first production from Heartstring Theatre, performed by an all-female cast. Alyssa, what do you think it does to this play to see it performed by only women?
I think it's really interesting because when Shakespeare was writing, he was writing really about human behaviour to me. So it's not that unusual because also in Shakespeare's time there was a lot of gender fluidity. You had 14-year-old boys playing 55-year-old women. So I think by just having all women, we are actually showing, as Joe said, the range of women's emotions that we haven't seen on stage before. And for me to even describe this play as masculine now, I just think, well, Coriolanus is honest. She's a warrior. She's very strong with her family. That's not masculine to me. That can be just as feminine. So hopefully when people see the show, they'll go, oh, wow, I haven't seen women portrayed this way, but this is how I see women as well.
Joe, I imagine both you and Alyssa have performed female roles in Shakespeare, Juliet or Desdemona or Ophelia. What has it been like for you to perform as angry, bloodthirsty leads in this play?
Yeah, it's been really fun, really good. There are some really interesting female roles that Shakespeare wrote as females, you know, Beatrice from Much Ado About Nothing, Volumnia, which is in Coriolanus. But a lot of the other roles are a little, you know, they're seen as a little weak. The woman who waits at home, the girlfriend who's a bit silly, you know, the, how do you put it?
The shrieking harpy.
The shrieking harpy.
Yeah.
But it was so interesting when we held auditions, the actors who came along, they were so excited. Most of them didn't want to play the actual, you know, traditionally the roles which were for the females. They all wanted to play the other roles because, I mean, just what we get to speak about, some of the monologues that we get, it really is amazing. The actors have been so excited about the text and what we get to actually say because we just don't get those opportunities, you know. So it's been really... Everyone's loved it.
Alyssa, how about you? Are you looking forward to playing a Hamlet or a King Lear soon?
Oh, well, I think I'm a bit too young to play King Lear, but that could be an option. I would love to. I think by having more women playing male roles, the canon of roles for women to play has just exploded now. And hopefully audiences will become more and more used to seeing a female Richard III, a female Gloucester in King Lear. But for me personally, I'm loving playing this role and saying these words and being able to fight and being able to be angry and being able to abuse the audience at times, which I never would be able to do. So it's been great.
And there's definitely a trend as well in the last couple of years. All female Shakespeare's, they're around. Julius Caesar's been done, Henry V's been done, The Taming of the Shrew's about to be in New York and Sydney. I mean, why not? Why not tell these stories as if they're women? I honestly think William Shakespeare would approve. You know, I think he wasn't allowed to allow female actors to be in the shows back then. I think he'd approve. I think he'd be happy.
I reckon he'd be pretty stoked to see you guys up on stage. Congratulations on your first production and all the very best for the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Georgia Moody speaking to co-founders of Heartstring Theatre, Alyssa Armstrong and Joe Booth, and they're performing in the company's debut production, Coriolanus by Shakespeare, an all-female production of that show. And it's on at the Mechanics Institute in Brunswick, which is in Melbourne's Inner North, until the 8th of May. I'm Michael Cathcart. You're listening to Books and Arts. Ah, the sounds of Graham Bell, which is a lovely way of introducing Chris Wallace Crabb. Now, for 60 years, Chris has been producing books. He's written over 60, not 65 of them, 25 of them, books of poetry and artist books and literary criticism. And he's recently written a sonnet in praise of Shakespeare, because it's Shakespeare's 400th anniversary, the anniversary of his death, and I thought you'd like to hear that. So he's come in. He's a hugely distinguished poet. He's a bloke everyone seems to like. He won the Melbourne Prize for Literature last November, and that acknowledges a lifetime's achievement in literature. And Chris, you also had the enormous pleasure of teaching me at the University of Melbourne in the 1970s.
Unforgettable it was.
Unforgettable. That's how you are. All right, how did this come about? You've been commissioned to write a sonnet.
Yes, the Bailiw Library contacted me at Melbourne University and commissioned me to write a sonnet. And
well, you better remind us what a sonnet is.
A sonnet is a lyric of 14 lines, broadly broken into an 8-line bit and a 6-line bit, sometimes ending with a couplet. It came into the English language from Italy in the 1500s, and it really took on, and the poets of Shakespeare's generation wrote lots of sonnets. Shakespeare wrote over 100 of them.
They're meant to rhyme, aren't they, sonnets?
Yes, indeed. There's a complicated rhyme pattern, and the main change that the English sonnet brought in against the French and Italian was that the last two lines rhymed together instead of being part of a complicated weave of rhyme.
You didn't teach me that in the 1970s. I didn't know that. All these years, I didn't know that.
You live and learn.
I'm glad we've been reunited. All right. So do we need to know anything else before you read the sonnet for us?
No. The phrase, Darling Buds of May, comes from one of Shakespeare's sonnets.
All right, we don't need the footnotes.
Et cetera.
Yeah, okay. Here we go. Here's Chris Wallace Crabbe with his sonnet, which is called...
After 400 Years. Our words are drowsing, flat now on the page, but yours take on exuberant lives as they cavort, then grin or break hearts on a stage as wide as the world is. Buds of May, Master Shakespeare, far off south down here... Should I compare you to the seasons then, and to our multicoloured atmosphere? You devised all these maidens and those men. Falstaff, Juliet, Lear or Prospero, you dreamt them up and launched them on the boards. Alive with every hue from long ago, it is amazing what you built with words. Where wombats graze or politicians swerve, your plays play still in verity and verve.
How marvellous. Chris Wallace Crabbe reading his sonnet in praise of Shakespeare with wombats in it.
I thought it was important to introduce wombats into any praise of Shakespeare.
I think he's sadly lacking in marsupial appreciation.
Absolutely.
Shakespeare, so I'm glad you've rectified that. So you were commissioned to write this. Is that an odd thing for a poet to do? I mean, your partner is a portrait painter, and portrait painters are commissioned to do portraits. But we think of poetry as coming unbidden. On the wings of inspiration. Can you turn it on if someone's...
a poet can be professional as well.
Is not that right?
Not just airy-fairy and waiting for the muse to come tapping at his or her door.
So it can be a technical process. You can do it as a job of work.
You can indeed. Yeah. You can indeed, because there can be a lot of skill in writing a poem. In fact, if it's commissioned, you're probably more likely to use a traditional form to prove that you've...
Earned your money.
Yes, got all the machinery in place.
Right. And does the machinery help you find a way through, do you think?
Very often, yes. And this is what modern practitioners of much freer forms feel. Oh, it's easy for them. They just rhyme and the rhymes find the lines and so on. Ah, cool. That's a bit easy, isn't it?
I don't know why you're talking like the Artful Dodger, but fair enough.
Now, I won't go into that.
So Shakespeare's own sonnets are intriguing because he's slippery in the way he uses the form.
Yes.
He's marvellous. I mean, it all matches the rules, but the actual rhythm that you end up reading in just slides all over the place. But also because they hold out this tantalising promise that maybe we're going to learn something about Shakespeare the man, because we learn nothing about him in the plays. Do you feel that in the Shakespeare sonnets, that you have access to the inner man?
I feel we get aspects to cubist faces of the inner man, but we're never able to catch the whole bloke there. A great many of them are loved ones. Some of them, we think, to a certain kind of mistress, some to another kind of lover. Others are more generally about the passage of time and what is lost, what slips away. But if you go to this suite of over 100 sonnets, you don't catch an autobiographical sequence.
You don't really, do you?
No.
And there are so many theories about what the sonnets are about, which is an indication that he's still playing the game of hiding behind the paragraphs, hiding behind the stanzas.
That's right.
Yeah. But do you feel that poetry does give you access to poets as a rule, or do you have a position that a work of art becomes a thing unto itself and the inner life of the artist is no longer germane to what's actually out there in the world?
Alas, both aspects are true.
Well, we love that.
One strives to make something that is impersonal, marmoreal, complete, but at the same time we read Thomas Hardy for the grieving Thomas Hardy that's there in the poems, even in the best written poems. So yeah. It's to and fro and to and fro. Yeats sounds like Yeats, and yet the Yeats poems are not autobiographical. Fragments of autobiography, dramatic.
I always think that Keats sounds differently because we know he died young.
Yes.
You know, that if Keats had lived to be an old man, all this musing on the fragility of life in a 20-year-old man would seem a bit silly.
It would. It would. It's a great advantage for a poet's reputation to die young.
Yes. Well, Shakespeare, he died young. He died at 54.
Mm. That was not necessarily very young in the Elizabethan period.
No, I suppose it wasn't. I just can't believe that he did all that. I feel like I'm still warming up and I'm older than Shakespeare and, you know, I'm wondering whether I've got it in me to kind of match that kind of
outlook. Of course you have, Michael.
Well, you know me so well. You've marked my essays. Thank you so much for coming. And, oh, before you go, just tell us very quickly about the study of Western magic that you're working on. What's that?
I'm interested in the relation of magic to religion on the one hand and to art on the other side, on the other hand, because in both cases it seems to produce something that is not just part of the empirical everyday world.
And this is going to be a book of essays and reflections on this.
I've no idea what form it is going to take yet.
Because it's not a commission.
That's right.
He only knows the form when it's a commission. Professor, thank you so much for gracing me in Studio 306 and the listener.
Thank you, Michael.
Chris Wallace Crabb, poet Chris Wallace Crabb. So that's a Shakespearean sonnet that features a wombat, and it's going to be put on a brass plaque and displayed somewhere at the University of Melbourne, at the Bayleu Library, I think. So that's a lovely tribute. Shakespeare with a wombat. I'd like to see the artwork that goes with that, Shakespeare with a wombat. Well, thank you for your company on this RN podcast. It's always nice to talk to you here on podcasts. And of course, there are lots of marvellous programs at RN. If you just go to the homepage and troll through there, you'll find so many programs that you can download and enjoy. Now, you might have heard the very sad news that David Page, the resident composer at Bangarra Dance Theatre, has died unexpectedly. He's the brother of Bangarra's artistic director, Stephen Page. And in a statement, the company said the Bangarra clan is unbelievably saddened at our brother David Page's death, that saddened that he's no longer with us. He'll be remembered for his achingly haunting compositions for the company, which fused electronic music with powerful Aboriginal language and stories. We'll end this podcast with a composition from the 2008 production, Mathina. This is the music of David Page. I'm Michael Cathcart. Toodaloo.